and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about king cake and Mardi Gras, most specifically in New Orleans.
Because we were just there.
Yeah.
And Carnival season is underway as we record this. Hard to say when you're listening to it.
Yeah, it could be any time. You could be a time traveler.
Ooh. If you are, please write in.
Oh, absolutely. Anyway, yes. Carnival season is the season in some Christianish traditions between Christmas and Lent. In New Orleans, you can also call the whole season Mardi Gras season, though the term does specifically apply to a single day.
And this year, the actual day of Mardi Gras, or Fat Tuesday, is taking place on March 5th. And this year is 2019, because again, time
we don't know.
Mm-hmm. I've never been to any Mardi Gras celebrations in New Orleans, but I have done a few in Atlanta, which, yes, I imagine are not the same.
Probably not.
No. But this is one of the things we heard about that surprised me the most, what Mardi Gras is really like in New Orleans. Because, yeah, I think we, super producer Dylan and Lauren and I, had a very particular idea of what Mardi Gras is. We spoke about it in studio when we got back from our trip.
This is another thing we learned about. A lot of Mardi Gras traditions I didn't know about. But yeah.
Yeah, because I think for a lot of us, when we think of Mardi Gras, we think of drunk people trying to get beads.
Yeah, like adults that are there to be drunk and like see boobs and, you know, cause havoc. Can be that, or that can be part of it. New Orleans receives an annual 1.4 million visitors during Mardi Gras season. There are parades and celebrations throughout, culminating in this final massive party of food and drink and music and dancing in the streets. Over 50 parades take place over the course of Carnival, organized by the famous crews like Endymion, Zulu, and Bacchus, and newer ones like Chewbacchus.
Love it.
Mm-hmm. There's huge, elaborate floats, often presided over by the crew's elected royalty. These days, an honor undertaken often by celebrities, from Spike Lee to Will Ferrell. Equally elaborate, often handmade and hand-designed costumes and throws. Throws being the handouts, from the ubiquitous plastic beads and doubloons and cups to painted coconuts, decorated shoes, decorated shrimp boots, purses and sunglasses, and bejeweled toilet brushes. All tossed or handed, for safety reasons, to the spectators who can catch a crew's attention.
So many questions about decorated shrimp boots, but we must forge ahead. Chris Horner, general manager over at the Bombay Club and the French Quarter, described the crowds and the chaos.
I've seen so many crazy things. You know, it's a Mardi Gras. I worked in restaurants on Bourbon Street. And the mass of the people, you know, when you just you can't walk down the street. You have it. It's difficult to walk down the street because there's so many beads on the street. It's amazing. It's just the crowd gets on Bourbon Street during Mardi Gras. Just that amazes me. But even more amazing is getting up early and watching them clean it up. It is, oh my gosh, how they do this? But they do it. They do it.
The plastic beads alone cause quite the problem.
It's a serious problem. HowStuffWorks did an article on it that I turned into a BrainStuff episode. To give you a sense of scale, from September of 2017 through January of 2018, cleaning crews flushed 93,000 pounds of beads alone out of storm drains along a five-block stretch of St. Charles Avenue downtown. That's about 42,000 kilograms and over 46 tons. To translate that into beluga whales, because that's clearly a unit of scale that we should use more often, that's about 31 beluga whales worth of beads.
That's how I measure most things. It's like always, you know, very, very small number of a beluga whale.
Sure.
Generally, I don't deal in that large of quantities.
Me neither.
This is a lot of beads, is what we're saying.
Yes. But there are efforts in place to ease the cleanup. None of them involve scaling down the party, however. But while Mardi Gras certainly can be a wild party, our interviewees told us a different side of the story. They described it as a family event, one celebrated among neighbors. Like, people make pots of gumbo large enough for sharing and leave their doors open so that friends and family and, you know, maybe passersby can just drop on in.
The celebrations are woven into the community. Think about it. This is a month-long celebration that really doesn't exist anywhere else in the United States. New Orleanians call it the greatest free show on earth. For people who grow up there, you take part in these celebrations, watching the parades from ladders, seeing the elaborate costumes, hearing the music, maybe marching in a parade as part of a high school marching band, or helping construct a float, and of course, eating the food.
Oh, that ladder thing. We didn't get it on tape, unfortunately, but when we were talking after our interview with Dickie Brennan to Dickie and Wesley Jansen, who put us in touch with him for the Brennan Company, yeah, they were saying that there's so little space on the streets that the real locals will bring a folding ladder,
yeah,
like a tall old folding ladder, and like duct tape a chair to the top of it.
Yeah.
Essentially, and then send, you know, whoever feels like that's the least precarious up to watch the parade from there.
It's so fantastic.
I love it. Huh. We also spoke with a music historian at the Historic New Orleans Collection, one Eric Seiferth, who described the electricity and the scents in the air during Mardi Gras and related celebrations.
The food is great. You can smell it from afar. You get a lot of barbecue. Not what kind of barbecue, I don't know. We're talking about big grills, yeah, where you can get all kinds of grilled chicken, hot sausage, smoked sausage, pork chops. I love the you can get just a pork chop, barbecue pork chop on between two pieces of white bread with the bone in it, and it's just delicious. This past year, in going downtown for Mardi Gras, we were driving on I-10 above Claiborne, and at Claiborne in Orleans, there's a big Mardi Gras celebration every year, and this, you know, you do this at like 8 in the morning, right? You got to start early for Mardi Gras on Mardi Gras Day, and you could just smell it. You could smell all the grills going and all the food getting ready at like 8 in the morning, and it's really a part of the, you know, it's exciting.
We also spoke to Ashley McMillan about her childhood memories. She's the executive pastry chef at Sucre New Orleans, a dessert boutique specializing in macaron, chocolate, and this time of year, that Mardi Gras dessert known as king cake.
We always went to Paris. We always had Popeye's chicken and a king cake, and that's just what it's been. So I'm not really sure where the history of that comes from. I think it's a gluttonous thing to do with Lent, too.
I've heard that Popeye's is a popular choice.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Huh, I've never been.
It's perhaps more popular over there than it is over here.
Perhaps.
But all of this is really just dancing around our question.
Mardi Gras and king cake. What are they?
Well, one thing at a time. Mardi Gras, or Carnival season, has its basis in Christian holidays. It starts on the holiday of the Epiphany, also called Three Kings Day, also called Twelfth Night. Like, you know, the 12 days of Christmas? This holiday is the Twelfth Night, and it falls on January 6th. The Carnival season ends with the actual day of Mardi Gras, also called Fat Tuesday or Shrove Tuesday. And this is not a specific calendar date. It's the day before Ash Wednesday, which is the first day of Lent, which is the 40 days leading up to the week before Easter. And since the date of Easter every year is determined by a lunisolar calendar, it's the first Sunday after the full moon, after the equinox, Mardi Gras itself can be any time between February 3rd and March 9th. During this season, you're allowed to, even supposed to, live it up, break the rules. And throughout, but especially on Fat Tuesday, you're supposed to use up rich ingredients like fats and sugars that you're expected to refrain from during the solemn season of Lent.
In that vein, the king cake is a seasonal treat in honor of the three kings, or magi, or wise men, said to have visited the baby Jesus when he was born.
Which is why king cakes are in the shape of a crown, or a more or less circular band. Anyway, king cakes in the New Orleans sense are a pastry typically made with thick twists or braids of yeast-raised Danish-style dough, though either flakier or fluffier dough is sometimes used. They're typically iced with three symbolic colors: purple for justice, green for faith, and gold for power. The cake can be plain or filled between the layers of dough with all sorts of things. Cinnamon and sugar is a little bit more traditional, but then sweetened cream cheese, jellies, and chopped sugared pecans are all also common. Once baked, a wee little plastic baby charm is typically placed somewhere inside the cake. These days, other tokens like coins or peas or pecans or beans were what was up in the past and may still show up.
Tradition holds that the plastic baby in the cake represents Jesus, and just like Jesus showed himself to the three wise men, he will show himself to those enjoying the king cake. Side note, I have never found the king, the baby.
Oh, I can't remember if I have.
I feel like you'd remember. It's pretty exciting. Well, I would imagine it is because it's never happened to me. But whoever does find the baby in their slice is crowned king for a day, and or host the Mardi Gras celebration, or at least buys the cake the next year.
It's a lucky token. So, yeah, the result of all of this is part dessert, or breakfast, I'm not judging, and part party game. And it's a giant Danish, right? Like, it's tender and dense and a little bit flaky, and depending on the icing and fillings, it can get pretty sweet.
And king cakes are a bit finicky to make. I attempted to make one once. It was fine. It was fine.
Oh, yeast breads, man.
Oh, yeast breads indeed. I generally just buy mine now, as do most Americans. And no sponsorship happening here, but I do usually get it from Sucre. Ashley spoke to us about Sucre's process when it comes to these pastries.
Whenever you do king cake dough, it's very technical. If you overproof it, then it falls. If you underproof it, it's raw. It's just a technical aspect of just making sure we're going up to every single person, checking what they're doing, sizing it up right. Sometimes you'll come in the kitchen and it's 95 degrees because we turn the entire building into a proof box, so that way the king cakes will proof long enough for us to get them into the ovens. We have a man that's been with us for about 5 years. His name is Hong, and he helps with everything with baking. He knows when to bake them, when to proof them, when to pull them. I mean, just a great thing. We hire help to come in. We do 8 different people sometimes that'll come in, shape, proof, bake, garnish. We have 8 people that just garnish. So all they're doing is glazing king cakes, waiting 4 hours for the glaze to dry, and then spraying them in gold lusters and all sorts of different colors. And then we have a whole packaging area. I mean, if you come in here during that season, you will be like, what? It's just everywhere. Everything is everywhere. And during that time, we don't set back any production with what we currently do. We make sure that chocolate room stays at the temperature it needs to stay at so nothing blooms, but everything else is hot as hot can be.
Despite the difficulty, hundreds of thousands of king cakes are sold out of New Orleans every Mardi Gras season. I couldn't track down a firm total, but the big commercial bakeries ramp up to producing 3,500 king cakes per day at their busiest. That's a lot of plastic babies.
Indeed. During the carnival season, the New Orleans NBA mascot is a king cake baby. We love a funny mascot. But actually, this one is more terrifying. Yeah. And I believe the people behind it are pursuing a lawsuit against the baby mascot serial killer in the Happy Death Day series.
The resemblance is remarkable.
It is.
You can look it up. The design is based on traditional carnival parade costumes consisting of these hugely oversized cartoonish papier-mâché heads on normal-sized bodies. And these designs go back hundreds of years and are frequently, like, mocking or kind of grotesque. So it's not, like, surprising the mascot designer is having to sue a horror designer.
Yeah.
But, you know, do yourself a favor and look it up. Or don't, depending on what kind of favors you like to do yourself.
Oh, no, do it.
Anyway, yes, king cake. The Danish dough type is perhaps the most popular, but it is not the only kind.
And New Orleans isn't the only place to serve king cakes. By far. In northern France, you can find galette d'oie, a flaky puff pastry filled with frangipane almond cream. Usually, a pattern is burned on top before baking with a bean or fève, which is baked inside. Sometimes, it is completed and served with a paper crown.
You can find a galette d'oie in some French bakeries around New Orleans.
Similar, but not exactly the same, Bulgaria's phyllo del banitsa and Greece's crumbly almond top Vassilopita, traditionally served on New Year's Day and New Year's Eve, respectively.
The New Orleans king cake, in contrast to these, is closer to the gâteau de rat from southern France, which is made with brioche, and also to the rosca de reyes from Spain, which is a ring of sweet bread topped with icing and candied fruit, which makes sense given the city's history with southern French and Spanish settlers.
And we'll get into that history of king cake and Mardi Gras after a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Like a lot of things in New Orleans, Mardi Gras is a French import influenced by all the other cultures that we have talked about in that area.
And as we talked about in our jelly donut episode, of all places, Mardi Gras and other carnival celebrations have roots that go way back. People have been celebrating the end of winter and the return of longer, warmer days forever. Since the first brave human who dared to celebrate.
So brave.
So brave. Ancient Babylonia might have held the first carnival circa 2600 BCE. This was a festival that celebrated mirth and change through satire by making a show of role reversals. There would be a parade through the streets. A pair of peasants would be royalty for the day, and the real royalty would act like fools. Pranks were played. Folks would wear costumes depicting social classes other than their own. Everyone partied. And these traditions would be incorporated into and or disseminated through Grecian and Roman cultural traditions like the Bacchanalia and Lupercalia and Saturnalia, and then Christian traditions, especially Catholic ones. During the Middle Ages, like maybe 900 to 1300 CE, these traditions became super popular all throughout Europe, and lots of specific but certainly related forms of carnival started developing and getting passed around.
Is this what was going on in The Hunchback of Notre Dame?
Oh, that's another one I've never seen. Probably.
It's got a really dark song in it for a Disney movie, I gotta say.
I mean, the whole thing is pretty dark for a...
It's grim. It's grim.
It's not really nice.
I guess this is research for later.
Yeah.
off mic, outside of podcast. Anyway, during the 17th and 18th century, France celebrated the fatting of the calf, Boeuf Gras, before Lent, and they brought the tradition to New Orleans. And of course, New Orleans took it and ran with it and made it their own. We discussed in our overview episode French-Canadian explorer Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne Sieur de Bienville, who is credited with naming New Orleans. Along with his brother, Pierre Lemoyne Sieur d'Iberville, Bienville also named a point about 60 miles south, Point du Mardi Gras, after they realized that it was the night before the holiday when they were picking out the name. He also set up and named Fort Louis de Louisiane in 1702, modern-day Mobile, which, according to records, is the first place to celebrate Mardi Gras in the New World in 1703. Though it was small, it was apparently a success, enough so that the very next year, in 1704, a secret society was formed, similar to a crew today, Masque de la Mobile. It kept up until 1709, and in 1710, the Boeuf Gras Society was formed. It stuck around until 1861 and entailed a huge bull's head pushed by 16 men. The bull was known as Rex.
Heck yeah.
Heck yeah.
When New Orleans was established in 1718, Mardi Gras celebrations slowly started to become part of the city's fabric. The first informal parade may have happened in 1727 after a group of students returned from Paris with ideas and costumes. By the 1730s, street celebrations were common, and 1737 may have seen the first organized parade. Still no floats or beads, though.
In the early 1740s, Louisiana governor the Marquis de Vaudreuil laid the groundwork for the New Orleans Mardi Gras balls by setting up elegant society balls. The first known reference to Mardi Gras carnival appeared in a report to the Spanish colonial governing body in 1781. Around the same time, we get the first of what would become hundreds of New Orleans carnival clubs and organizations with the establishment of the Perseverance Benevolent and Mutual Aid Association.
This was one of the social aid clubs that we talked about, again, in that intro to New Orleans that we did, an organization founded by free people of color to help each other with life expenses and death expenses in times when the establishment denied them service. They also had great parties. By the 1830s, the city celebrated Mardi Gras with processions of masked horseback riders. The parade path was lit by gaslight torches called flambeaux. Then, in 1857, six folks from Mobile started the Mystic Crew of Comus, and they introduced the floats to the New Orleans Carnival parades and masquerade balls, because members of the crew were anonymous. The second crew of New Orleans formed in 1870, which is also the same year of the first Mardi Gras throws.
The Rex organization, one of the oldest organizations, solidified green, gold, and purple as Mardi Gras colors by 1872. These colors were chosen in honor of the visiting Russian Grand Duke, Alexis Romanov. They were his family's colors. The Rex organization also established Rex as the king of the daytime carnival. This century is also when we get the phrase neutral ground, which at first referenced the lines dividing municipalities, but now indicates the median that separates streets and is used as a descriptor for where a parade goer will stand. Neutral ground versus sidewalk side.
Ah. In 1875, the Mardi Gras Act made Mardi Gras a legal holiday in Louisiana, and it remains so to this day. And the parades and balls only got bigger through the 20th century as tourism and local wealth, for some, not all, increased. We saw some of the scepters and crowns of prior crew royalty on display at the historic New Orleans collection. Not like out front, though, just tucked away in the reading room where we did our interview with Amanda McPhillan and Dr. Jessica Harris. Like, oh, no big deal. Just, you know, if you happen to be in there, I guess maybe look at these spectacularly shiny things.
Hard not to look at them. Hard not to. And we got to see some vintage ball costumes up close during an impromptu visit to the Germain Wells Mardi Gras Museum, located in the massive, sprawling complex that also hosts Arnaud's, one of the oldest restaurants in New Orleans. The co-proprietor, Katie Kasparian, gave us a tour after our interview. It was amazing. We discussed it when we first got back. A Mardi Gras Museum.
Yeah.
And she showed it to us. It was a wonderful surprise.
Yes. Oh, man. Because one of the prior owners, the daughter of the original owner, was this amazing sounding spitfire of a woman who would commission these wild, beautiful, gigantic, intricate Mardi Gras dresses.
Yeah. Yeah. That and looked fabulous and also incredibly heavy.
Yeah. So you go up you go up one of the many winding stairways in this place and kind of go down one of the many winding hallways, and all of a sudden you're in this clothing museum. We're talking capes and dress trains 6 feet long and 6 feet wide, hundreds of thousands of gems and sequins. Also, one of the ghost stories we heard was set in those very hallways. Stay tuned after the credits to hear that one.
But hey, we're a food podcast, purportedly. What about the king cake? We'll get into that after a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So, the first king cakes may go all the way back to ancient Rome as part of the celebration of the aforementioned Saturnalia, which is a winter solstice and a harvest festival. A pastry would be baked with a fava bean hidden inside, and the finder would be named King of the Day. The tradition became a part of Epiphany celebrations in the Middle Ages. The fava bean was sometimes replaced by a porcelain token of a crowned head to take a little bit of the pagan out of the festival. And when Spain and France spread their outposts to the New World, the king cake tradition came with them and took on a life of its own, especially perhaps in New Orleans.
Like we said, the baby, or whatever small item was used, is largely believed to represent the baby Jesus. Another theory suggests that in colonial Louisiana, the baby, or really the bean or grain of rice that it probably was at the time, commemorated the king's ball. The lucky finder of the trinket, whatever it was, would be crowned king or queen of the balls preceding the grand finale, Mardi Gras.
Like you'd be crowned for a week and responsible for bringing the cake to the next ball a week later. Seems like a lot of balls. I love it.
It does, yeah.
Until the 1950s, things like coins or other trinkets were used. And this is also when Americans started ordering king cakes in larger numbers. It wasn't a baby until a bakery called McKenzie's came up with the idea. And at first, these figures were, made out of porcelain and baked into the cake. But as plastic became cheaper, they were eventually replaced with that, which comes alongside the cake and not baked into it due to, concerns about baking plastic.
Right.
No, not delicious. These early cakes were also more bread-like or brioche-like or pan dulce-like. And they didn't have filling yet either. That didn't come around until the 1980s as bakers began adding more eggs and sugar to the recipes or straight up switching to Danish pastry recipes. An anecdotal tale puts the first commercial filled king cakes in New Orleans to 1983. According to our friend Liz Williams, according to Joan Seaman, that year Joan's bakery baked 4 filled cakes. Her husband took 1 to work, and they got 25 calls about filled cakes within 30 minutes.
That's some good marketing, accidental or otherwise. This is when shipping technology improved as well, in part thanks to folks moving out of New Orleans due to the boom bust, but still wanting their king cakes, and also due to food editors. Quickly, demand grew. By 1992, 19 bakeries in Louisiana, in conjunction with the United States Postal Service, offered overnight delivery for $18. According to Federal Express, they had been shipping 30,000 king cakes annually since 1988.
Remember that that's around when Cajun and Creole food really hit the national scene. With this national trend status and the honed sense of community history and pride that rose up after Katrina, you've got a veritable glut of king cake options today. Miniature king cakes, king cake donuts, king cake vodka, king cake bourbon milk punch, a king cake smoothie, and, of course, in a city that loves a party, a king cake festival held in late January.
Of course. Well, that about brings us to the end of this episode. And listeners, we would love to hear from you. Have you been to this festival? Do you have a king cake recipe or a favorite shop to buy one at? Please let us know at hello@saverpod.com.
You can also find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SaverPod. We hope to hear from you. Thank you, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard, our executive producer, Christopher Hasiotis, and our interviewees, and the good folks who put us in touch with those interviewees. Thank you to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.
So that museum was created in honor of Germaine Wells, the founder's daughter, who ran the restaurant for 30 years. She presided over more Mardi Gras balls than any other woman, and she had created these mannequins to resemble her and had these gowns that she wore put on the mannequins, and it was in a back of house area that people could go see. But when my parents bought the restaurant and renovated, they ended up with sort of an unusable, awkward space that could have only been used for storage at some point. But they had all of these things, so they decided to make a museum in her honor. So it's a very quirky, spooky, amazing space that people love still to this day to come see. And anyone can come. You don't have to dine here. It's open during our operating hours. So that's the backstory in the museum. There were some workers who did work here all the time, so it wasn't like they had just were here for that project. They were doing some painting or something in the space, and it was before we were open, so it wasn't during our operating hours. This woman came up the steps and was confused about getting out. It's easy to get turned around in here. So, and it was 2 of them, and one of them had gone to go, rinse off a paintbrush or something. This woman's confused about getting out, so this guy's instructing her how to get out. He has a conversation with her. She follows his instruction, but almost like immediately the other guy comes back up, and so the guy that gave the instruction said, "Hey, did you see that woman got out?" And he said, "What are you talking about? There was no woman. We're the only ones here. The restaurant's closed. There's no woman here." That was story number 2. Always a good one. Yeah.